Okay, the House Resources Committee is called to order at 1:03 p.m. on Friday, February 24th, 2023. We are meeting in Capitol Room 124. Present are Representative Sadler, Representative Mears, Representative Armstrong, Representative Dibert, Representative McCabe, and myself, Representative McKay. Do we have anybody on the phone? Is George on the Representative Rauscher on the phone by chance? Okay, I just wanted to check. All right. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to do business. I'd like to thank our recorder, Justin, and our moderator, Zach, for helping keep everything in order today, and our committee aide, Ed King. As a reminder, please silence your cell phones. We will now bring back HB 50, carbon storage, before the committee. This is the sixth hearing on HB 50. We have some invited testimony today. Mr. Kevin Connors, can you hear me all right, Mr. Connors, while I introduce you?
Yes, I'm
muted. Can you unmute yourself, Mr. Connors? I thought it'd be better if he can hear my introduction of him. Can you hear me now, Mr. Connors? We cannot hear you.
I'm afraid if I'm on my phone.
There you go. We can hear you now. Okay, so today we will have Mr. Kevin Connors with PCOR Partnership is with us via video conference. PCOR is focused on carbon capture and storage utilization projects and is affiliated with the University of North Dakota's Energy and Environmental Research Center. He has been working with our university system in Alaska on CO2 storage projects and has some insight for us. Mr. Connors, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Chairman McKay, and I'm sorry, is it okay if I turn my phone off and just use Teams because I'm getting feedback?
We can hear you just fine at this end.
Okay, I'm getting feedback on both of it.
He just has to mute either his phone or his
mute. Maybe you can mute and use your phone, whatever works.
We'll go ahead and use and work it out.
Okay. Okay, we're back on the record.
Can everyone hear me?
Okay, can you hear me now, Mr. Connors?
Yeah.
Okay, you may have to mute one thing or another so you don't get the feedback and we don't hear an echo. And I don't see any slides. Do you have slides?
Okay, sorry. I do not have slides.
Yeah, I think we're going to get an echo. Mr. Connors, we need to do something different.
Okay. Is that better?
That's better.
Okay. I'm still getting it on my end, so it's confusing me.
He has to turn off the sound on his computer.
You may have to turn off the sound on your computer.
I'm sorry about that. So my name is Kevin Connors. I'm with the Energy and Environmental Research Center at the University of North Dakota. My title at the EERC is Assistant Director for Regulatory Compliance Energy Policy. I'm here to testify on behalf of House Bill 50. A little bit of background about myself. I have a background in geology, started my career in the oil fields of Western North Dakota, and early in my career, went to work for the state of North Dakota as a petroleum engineer, and in 2011, the state created a new position called CCS Supervisor, and I was given that opportunity, which was to lead North Dakota's efforts in developing a regulatory program for CO2 storage, and ultimately lead North Dakota's efforts to become the first state in the nation to have Class 6 primacy which I believe is directly related to this House Bill 50 and the state's legislature's direction for the state of Alaska to pursue Class 6 primacy, and I would be happy to talk about the importance of that. North Dakota has a complete comprehensive framework in place to regulate geologic storage, and that's where my expertise and understanding comes in. And it really all dates back to 2002. Two very important things happened in 2002. The first of which is, at the time, it was our, then, President George Bush. And he committed the U.S. to a comprehensive strategy to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And there was funding in place for the Department of Energy to create the Regional Carbon Sequestration Partnership Program. One of the partnership programs is the P-Corp partnership, which you referenced in your introduction, or the Plains CO2 Reduction Partnership. Through the P-Corp partnership, which I get the great honor and privilege to manage today, we've been conducting applied research in CCS and CCUS for over 20 years. In 2019, Alaska became part of the P-Corp partnership, and since that time, the EERC has been partnered with University of Alaska Fairbanks to advance CCS and CCUS in the state of Alaska. Today, the P-Corp partnership is focused on commercial deployment, but in that 20-year history, we've gone through a series of phases that began with characterization work, some pilot testing or small-scale field validation, commercial demonstration where we partnered with an industry partner to demonstrate over 1 million tons of CO2 stored in association with enhanced oil recovery in a CO2 enhanced oil recovery project in southeastern Montana. And then today, we're at a very much a commercialization phase, actually an accelerated commercialization phase. The P-Corp partnership is made up of over 240 members that represent industry. So it's the oil and gas industry, the coal mining, electricity generation industry, the gas processing, gas transportation industry, the ethanol industry. We have software providers, technology providers, engineering consulting firms, tax equity firms, companies that are just focused on advancing commercial CCS, government agencies, and academia. So including for the Alaska portion of P-Corps, we have partnerships with the Department of Natural Resources and the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, and then Hillcorp is also a P-Corps partner in terms of our industry partners. The P-Corps partnership today still leverages federal research dollars from the Department of Energy plus industry dollars. And again, we're focused on commercial CCUS deployment.
Okay, Mr.
The other
Connors,
thing that happened in 2002 is the Interstate Oil and Gas Compact Commission, which Alaska is a member state, developed a task force. And that task force was made up of state oil and gas regulators and also some representatives from the Department of Energy and then also representatives from the P-Corps partnership at the time. And the IOGCC task force was focused on regulating carbon storage, and they were ultimately trying to answer a question, are states or the federal government the most appropriate regulator to regulate geologic storage of carbon dioxide? The task force ultimately came out with the recommendation that to best facilitate orderly development of geologic storage of carbon dioxide within states, that the states, and they also looked at the Canadian provinces, should be the lead or take the lead and embrace two basic principles, that it's in the public interest to promote geologic storage of carbon dioxide, and that pore space in the state should be regulated and managed as a resource under a resource management framework. And that's really what I'm here to talk about today, is House Bill 50. House Bill 50 is certainly a resource management framework. It dates back to this early effort by the IOGCC. That IOGCC task force, they developed model statute, model regulations in 2007. And then ultimately, North Dakota took those model statutes and model regulations. North Dakota developed a CO2 storage work group and customized the statute to the state's needs. And in 2009, North Dakota adopted legislation very similar to House Bill 50 to regulate geologic storage of carbon dioxide under a resource management framework in terms of promoting geologic storage in the state, that it's for the best of the state or it's in the interest of the state, and then also recognizing that the pore space is regulated as a resource under a resource management framework. North Dakota followed that by applying for and receiving Class 6 primacy, and that's where I come into the picture. And what I'd like the committee to know and understand is those early decisions that were made in North Dakota in 2008 with the work group and ultimately with our state legislature was really focused around providing regulatory certainty for an eventual CCUS industry. You see, there's a handful of important pieces to the puzzle in terms of geologic storage that need to be accounted for in order to have say a commercial CCUS industry or investment and developing CCS projects. The first is to have the industry, and I think the state of North Dakota and Alaska have a great commonality there with we're both energy states. We both produce and export energy. You have to have the right geology. That's key. And I believe the early work that we've done in Alaska and the work that's been done thus far and that will continue to be done is demonstrating that you do have suitable geology in Alaska for geologic storage of carbon dioxide. The third thing is research and development, and that's where our partnership with UAF and the Peace Corps partnership and the work that is going to continue to be done in Alaska positions your state and from a technical standpoint. And then very importantly, the policy and regulation play that role in providing regulatory certainty for a CCS and the CCUS industry that we see today, specifically in North Dakota. Because North Dakota has similar legislation and ultimately today a law in place that you are considering today, followed by Class 6 primacy, North Dakota has positioned itself to see a lot of activity. There's a CCUS industry, there's investment coming into the state, and there's projects that are being developed. One thing that I failed to mention is a little bit of my background. I worked for the state of North Dakota for 8 years, helped develop that regulatory program, and then today I'm at the EERC where I'm working directly with industry to help develop projects, everything from CO2 storage projects, everything from site screening through feasibility and characterization all the way through permitting and into operation and monitoring those active sites from a commercial standpoint. Today, North Dakota has permitted 4 projects. There's a 5th project that actually is being heard in the month of March, and there's several other projects in earlier stages of development today, with the first commercial storage project that went into operation in North Dakota in June of 2022. So there's a lot of activity. There's a lot of investment in the state, and I believe that what's driving that investment is having the regulatory certainty that North Dakota so importantly worked toward in 15 or so years ago in the original legislation, very similar to what your committee is considering today.
Mr. Connors, I need to recognize contrast, Mr. Connors.
When we talk about Class 6 primacy, and I'd love to explain that if there's any questions. If you do not have Class 6 primacy, the EPA is the regulatory authority for this activity.
I need to recognize Representative Kroc has joined us at 1:07 p.m. Okay. Can you hear me, Mr. Connors?
Yes, sir.
Okay, maybe
yes.
Every once in a while I'll take a little gap, okay? So if we have a question or we need to announce something, we can get it in, okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Please continue.
What I was describing was in terms of Class 6 primacy, if you do not Class 6 primacy, EPA is the regulatory authority. And in that instance, basically there's only 2 states in the nation that have Class 6 primacy. It's North Dakota and Wyoming. Everywhere else, it's the EPA regional office that's regulating this activity. And so to give you an example or a contrast, currently, I looked this morning, there's 42 permit applications in with the different EPA regional offices across the country, none of which have been approved today. There's 2 approved permits in Illinois that have been in operations, and those permits took over 5 years for those companies. It's actually ABM is the operator to get approval. To contrast that, North Dakota with Class 6 primacy and the proper laws and statutes in place has issued permits in less than a year. For those 4 projects that have been permitted.
Hmm. Okay.
And with that, I mean, I think what was most important for myself was to make myself available to the committee for questions. I can go into any further detail if you have any further questions.
Okay, very good. Can you hear me, Mr. Connors?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm sorry about the technical glitches here. Okay. Does anybody have any questions for Mr. Connors? Okay. Representative Mears has a question for you, Mr. Connors.
Thank you, through the chair. You jumped into things pretty quick and fast, and I don't think I have clarity on how the P Corp partnership works, and I got who all's involved, but how that works, and I guess that's it.
Okay, so Mr. Connors?
Chairman McKay and committee members, so I'd like to, I'm happy to explain the P Corp partnership a little further. So the P Corp partnership is a research and development program. We receive funding from the Department of Energy and from our partner organizations. Today, we're very much a growing organization. It's much like a consortium where we have over 240 members. And basically, a great way to look at P Corp is over 20 years of applied research in CCUS, we have built up the technical foundation today that the commercial industry that we very much see in different areas of the country, including North Dakota, are launching off of. And so we do geologic characterization work. So we identify the ideal geology for geologic storage of carbon dioxide, or in other words, where to inject and store large volumes of carbon dioxide. We're very much focused on infrastructure development. And also developing prudent regulatory frameworks and engaging our regulators across the region. There's a public outreach component to the P Corp partnership, and we're very much today we're focused on building the technical foundation, identifying any challenges, and ultimately finding solutions to those challenges so we can have accelerated commercial deployment. Maybe going back a little bit, the P Corp partnership, as I mentioned, it started out just doing early characterization work. We were basically trying to answer the question, is CCS possible? And do we have the industry and do we have the geology? That led to some field testing and commercial demonstration. But today we're in the phase we're in, we're focused on commercial deployment. Now, Alaska came into the P Corp partnership in 2019, where we've been looking at the geology, looking at the industry of the state, and we see a real opportunity for commercial deployment of CO2 storage or geologic storage of carbon dioxide in the state of Alaska.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Connors. No follow-up? Okay, great. Okay, now we have a question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Connors, can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
Just want to confirm. Very good. My question would be this. Obviously, you're looking to draw some parallels between what North Dakota has done and what Alaska has before us in HB 50. As North Dakota's CCUS industry has entered the commercial development stage, what can you tell us briefly or even in detail? What has worked as you envisioned it would work, and what has not worked as you originally envisioned it?
Chairman McKay and committee members, great question. Early on in North Dakota, and really in 2008, our work group was very much focused on our coal and power and electricity generation industry and creating regulatory certainty moving forward for advancement in carbon capture technology. We knew at the time that our geology was looking very ideal for geologic storage, and we were anticipating future advancements in capture technology, which are here today. But in the early days, it was really focused around our coal fleet in North Dakota and providing certainty around our ability to continue to generate electricity, which we export to other states in the region. And we also in North Dakota have an 800-year supply of lignite coal that is very important to the state's economy. And it's very important to our state to be able to always be able to utilize that resource well into the future. And so we saw CCS as a great opportunity or solution for the long-term viability of our state and specifically our coal and power industries. Today, how that's changed is certainly it's not only the coal and electricity generation industry, which is pursuing carbon capture and storage projects, pursuing investment But we're also seeing a large interest from our oil and gas industry, and I'll explain that in a minute. Our gas processing and gas transportation industry, and then also our ethanol industry. So we've seen a lot of interest across the board, and in our state, you know, those industries, oil and gas, electricity, oil and gas, coal-fired power plants, and ethanol, are robust industries, but they're also the emissions associated with those industries are carbon intensive. And so we're seeing a real opportunity, and we look at it as carbon management to manage or reduce the carbon intensity of those industries while still allowing them to thrive over time and continue to grow. And so what we've seen is the early work that we put in North Dakota in establishing the right frameworks and policies, the seeds we sowed back in 2008 and 2009, we're seeing the fruit today for all of our major industries in the state be able to pursue carbon capture and storage ultimately.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Connors. Follow-up, Rep. Sadler? No?
Yes, I would, actually.
Okay, follow-up.
Boy, that leads to a lot of trains through the chair, Mr. Connors. So what has been a surprise for you? What has not developed as you thought it would?
Chairman McKay, committee members, I'd have to say, you know, I don't have a whole lot of surprises in North Dakota. What has been a surprise is the challenges associated with other states developing the regulatory frameworks and receiving that approval from EPA. And even North Dakota, it took several years for EPA to approve North Dakota's Class 6 program. Granted, North Dakota was the first, and it took 5 years to get approval from EPA to regulate this activity. And then Wyoming followed that, and it took Wyoming about 2.5 years. Today, Louisiana has applied for primacy and is currently pending that approval. And I believe they're about 1.5 years into that application being submitted to EPA. And so what's surprising is ultimately the federal government's inability to provide states this authority that they recognize is actually important in the preamble to the federal Class 6 rule that was published in 2010 recognizes that the states have the additional flexibility beyond the Safe Drinking Water Act, beyond the USC program to regulate Class 6. And it actually recognizes that states are best suited to regulate this activity. Now there's some reluctance, and it's a slower process than it should be to provide states with primacy. I would like to note for the committee that not only North Dakota adopted a very similar legislation, but Wyoming and Montana has. Most recently, Nebraska has adopted very similar legislation to House Bill 50, and Utah as well, just to name a few states.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Connors. We have a question from Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Mr. Connors. So I just want to be real clear for some of my constituents who are very concerned about this. So you now have your industries, such as your coal industry and oil and gas industry and your gas transportation industry and various industries in North Dakota. They're now thriving because of the framework that you put in place, and it was a framework years ago, is what I heard you say. So was it worth the money? We're looking at $1.2 million right now to invest into this as a fiscal note or somewhere close to that. And the question is it worth the money for us? And I assume from what you said that you would say it's well worth the money because your industries are thriving because of what your legislature did 5 years ago or 6 years ago. So maybe you could just confirm.
Chairman McKay, committee members, as a point of clarification,
Yeah, please proceed, Mr. Connors.
Okay. As a point of clarification, what we want is for our industries to always be able to thrive in North Dakota through, carbon management as a potential solution. And so what I'd like to point out, so this was 15 years ago. I would say, I hear today You know, we tend to talk about today what we see in terms of the industry and the investment in the state of North Dakota, how happy we are as a state that we made these decisions early on, and the foresight that we had in North Dakota is driving investment into the state. In 2001, our governor announced that the state, an ambitious goal that the state of North Dakota would be carbon neutral by 2030. And with the announcement of that goal, and with the state having Class VI primacy and the state focused on reducing the carbon intensities of our energy industries, we've seen over $15 billion of investment come into the state. And we see a great economic opportunity for the state of North Dakota related to managing the carbon emissions associated with our energy and agriculture industries.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Sadler has another question.
Very good. Thank you, through the chair, Mr. Connors. I know that we watched as North Dakota was the home of the fracking revolution and the great benefits that brought to your state and to others in the lower 48. I'm curious to know what has been the interplay between the existing oil and gas industry in North Dakota and the nascent carbon capture and storage industry. And if you could actually characterize the first four permits, what kind of facilities are injecting CO2 through those four permits?
Chairman McKay, committee members, I'm delighted to answer this question. Everything that we're doing in carbon capture and storage, I'd say just geologic storage, everything we're doing in terms of subsurface characterization, drilling injection wells, monitoring the CO2 in the subsurface, those technologies and the engineering and the advancement of those materials has all been derived from the oil and gas industry. So our oil and gas industry is directly related to the geologic storage aspects of carbon capture and storage to the point where we wouldn't be where we are today without our oil and gas industry. Now, we see an opportunity in North Dakota to have both saline storage and have a wide-scale CO2 enhanced oil recovery. You mentioned the Bakken Formation. We've been doing research for several years now at the EERC on the Bakken Formation, it being a tight oil-bearing formation that, as you mentioned, requires the advancement of technology in terms of horizontal drilling, hydraulic fracturing in order to be as prolific and productive as it is. We are certainly looking at CO2 enhanced oil recovery for the future of the Bakken. And today, what we're seeing is the driver today, there's a 45Q tax credit that's driving saline storage projects or geologic storage projects and the infrastructure build out for that. We see a future opportunity in North Dakota to have wide scale CO2 enhanced oil recovery, which would allow for us to maximize the recovery of our oil and gas reservoirs and our oil and gas resources in the state of North Dakota. So long-term vision, we see carbon management with both CCS and CCUS, in other words, carbon capture utilization and storage, utilizing that CO2 to maximize the recovery of our oil and gas resources, both in the Bakken, which is our unconventional resources, and in our conventional reservoirs as well. We have great opportunity to continue to maximize those resources for the betterment of the state of North Dakota and to allow the CO2 that's stored in association with enhanced oil recovery to be counted toward reducing carbon emissions and ultimately creating a low carbon intensity oil. The second part of your question, the four permits that have been issued. The first permit that was issued was a single ethanol plant in located in North Dakota. It just happens to sit on phenomenal geology. It's a Red Trail Energy. It emits about 180,000 metric tons of CO2 per year. So on the scale of things, it's a smaller scale project. That project was permitted in 8 months in North Dakota. And that's the commercial project that's since gone into operation and when it began injecting CO2 in June. The second permits, there's actually second and third permits were permitted together in terms of it's a stacked storage situation where they're looking at multiple geologic horizons that are separated by thousands of foot of different geologic units, but they're stacked on top of each other in terms of the subsurface. So there were two permits submitted at the same time that were both approved at the same time, and that was with Minn Kota Power Cooperative. It's a coal-fired power plant in center North Dakota called the Milton R. Young Station, and we characterized and worked with Minn Kota to characterize the geology and permit the site right there that lies below their power plant. The fourth permit was just issued in January of 2023, and that's at a Synfuels plant. So it's called the Great Plains Synfuels plant. It's a subsidiary of Basin Electric, and that's an interesting plant. So they're taking North Dakota lignite coal, and they're applying the coal gasification process to it. And there's the ability to capture the CO2 off that stream. And that facility has been capturing CO2 since 2000. And there's actually a pipeline that transports that CO2 about 2 million tons a year into the oil fields in southern Saskatchewan. So it's about a 200-mile pipeline. There's about a million or so metric tons of CO2 that was not being captured. And so the EERC worked with Basin Electric to characterize the site right there underneath their facility, again, sitting on top of the right geology. And we worked closely with them to help permit their site, which they just received approval for in early this year.
Cool. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Connors. Representative Armstrong has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Connors, through the chair. I think I heard you say that you've had $15 million in investment, and I'm curious to know if you are currently profitable, if that was a goal, and if so, how long did it take from when you received primacy until this program started being profitable?
Chairman McKay, committee members, just want to clarify, the state in itself has seen $15 billion in investment in developing CCS sites. That's not necessarily the state receiving that money. That's the investment that's coming into the state to develop projects. And we're talking about, you know, infrastructure development, building capture units that are billion-dollar capture units, building multi-state pipelines to bring CO2 into the state. And so I'd like to clarify when this activity began. And so North Dakota applied for Class VI primacy in 2013. North Dakota was awarded primacy in 2018. Also in 2018, a very important thing happened is the federal government, the legislature adjusted or amended the 45Q tax credit. It wasn't immediate. When that tax credit was amended, they increased the value of the tax credit. At the time, I want to say, I'm pretty sure it was $50 a ton $50 a ton for saline storage and $35 a ton for storage that's associated with enhanced oil recovery in terms of CO2 enhanced oil recovery. What happened was you didn't see immediate reaction from industry in that, but because there was uncertainty with the amendments to the law. And so the IRS came out with guidance, multiple guidance documents that described start of construction and provided clarity there for the industry. And then IRS came out with a rulemaking. And once IRS provided certainty around the 45Q tax credit amendments, then you started seeing a lot of interest in industry. It tipped the scales for the economics of these projects. Now, just this last, in 2022, with the Inflation Reduction Act, there was an additional increase or enhancement to the 45Q tax credit to bump it up from $50 a ton for saline storage to $85 a ton for saline storage. And that also bumped up CO2 enhanced oil recovery, the tax credit associated with that to $60 a ton. And it provided a much larger tax credit for direct air capture. And so, that federal tax credit, that federal incentive is a major driver for commercial, projects today, specifically in North Dakota, but I'd say across the country in the United States.
Okay. Rep. Armstrong has a follow up.
So just to clarify, the biggest benefit so far has been investment in the state versus actually seeing revenue come in. And do you have any idea of just how much the state has to outlay over how many years before you start to see this become directly profitable to the state treasury? I understand the economic impacts of, $15 billion in investment is definitely not insignificant, but just cash in, cash out in terms of what the state is putting out in terms of expenses to stand up the program and how long you might anticipate it could be profitable, or your answer might be that that is not really the goal, that the ancillary benefits around investment and supporting oil and gas and coal is what you're more focused on, and profit would just be a nice to have and not a need to have. So just curious if you can walk me through that.
Chairman McKay and committee members. Thank you for the clarification of the question. I don't want to necessarily represent the state of North Dakota in that aspect and speak for the state, but what I can speak to is In terms of the statute that was adopted in North Dakota, creating two trust fund accounts, the carbon dioxide trust fund account, and the administrative trust fund account, so two accounts. And ultimately those accounts are in place, for, when carbon dioxide injection begins, or any individual project that's injecting, there's a per ton fee that's associated with the injection of CO2. Part of that fee goes to the administration fund, and part of it goes to the long-term liability fund, or the long-term management fund, I should say. And so the state was looking for a sustainable regulatory program, and ultimately, it was an opportunity to provide certainty, for the state energy and agriculture industries today is what we're seeing.
Yeah, Mr. Connors, this is Chair McKay. If I could maybe give you I guess you're probably really familiar with this, but in Alaska, the state is basically the subsurface landowner. So our view of this has a particular bias towards, frankly, how much money is the state going to make, and how fast would we recover our investment if we had a class six well on the slope and a class six well on the Kenai Peninsula, for example, because we basically own these depleted reservoirs where the CO2 would go. And I think our folks kind of want to know, we could initiate the primacy class six well process, spend $2 or $3 million on that, and then maybe nothing happens. So I guess we're trying to get a feel for how other states have dealt with the situation where the state owns the subsurface mineral rights. So I'll let you chew on that.
Chairman McKay, committee members, thank you. Much different situation in North Dakota. First of all, the pore space ownership is the surface owner. And so that's predominantly privately owned, pore space. And so, the projects today that are being developed are very much, acquiring, for the most part, privately owned pore space. Now, probably like most states in the lower 48, especially in the West, there is some state trust lands, where there's some state revenues being generated from access to pore space or pore space leasing. I just can't answer anything specific to Alaska and the potential revenues there. That's just not my area of expertise. I'm sorry that I can't help the committee in that aspect, but certainly the projects that are moving forward today, we're seeing a benefit for use of pore space, which until CO2 storage came around, didn't have any value at all. And so we're seeing great economic opportunity even for something that, really prior to this activity, there was no compensation for that particular, geologic formation that didn't involve any, these formations don't have hydrocarbons or minerals within them. So there was no value there up until today. Now there's obviously value. What I can speak to that may help the committee is the projects, and the economics of those projects are much different. A coal-fired power plant, would have different economics than, say, an ethanol production facility or even a natural gas processing facility where the CO2 is being captured from. There's different values there for that CO2 based on the tax credit and other types of markets. We're seeing the ethanol industries in particular in kind of the Corn Belt or the Midwest United States really accelerate CCS because there's other carbon markets out there for the ethanol product that's produced. So we do have, obviously I laid out kind of the couple of the projects that we're seeing in North Dakota, and each project has different economics associated with that project, therefore different ability to pay for pore space access. It's not a one-size-fits-all in terms of pore space leasing.
Okay, I got a follow-up. I know Rep. Sadler has a question, but let me quickly follow up. So the way I understand it, if I heard you earlier, there's four Class 6 wells in North Dakota, or maybe there's more than that. Who owns those Class 6 wells? who owns and operates the wells? We understand that the pore space is owned by the private property owner. So the Class 6 well that's on that person's property, who owns the well, who operates it, who drilled it, if you follow my train of thought?
Yeah, Chairman McKay and committee members, so those projects are being developed by commercial operators. We call them the first wave of projects in North Dakota are somewhat unique, and I think it's already looking different as next wave of projects are developed. But these projects are co-located basically with facilities that are in existence that own property, right? Especially a good example is our coal-fired power plants. In North Dakota, lignite coal is a kind of a heavier coal to mine, and so we have mine-to-mouth operation. We build the plant right there on top, right there in vicinity to the mine. And the coal mine and the coal mining company owns that land, that surface. And so as we develop the storage projects around these sites, the pore space owner is, at least in these first four projects that have been permitted, predominantly is the project developer or the facility owner. Now we're seeing projects that are coming in that are bringing CO2 in from longer distances in terms of developing pipelines, where they're accessing pore space, they're accessing the right to use the surface and to build a well pad and drill and construct Class 6 injection wells on surface that's being leased now today for other projects. But the first four projects, those wells are located on the property of the facility owner and ultimately the applicant, the operator.
Okay, very good. Okay, Rep. Sadler.
Please. Thank you. Through the Chair, Mr. Connors, and that is a perfect segue to my line of questioning. You had you identified that North Dakota is kind of taking care of homegrown needs. You mentioned investment in multi-state pipelines. So I'm wondering, just confirm for me that means that your North Dakota is accepting CO2 from other sources into at least one of those four projects that have been permitted. So my question to you is going to be, confirm that if you can, but is North Dakota likely to be a hub or a collector of other states' CO2? Is there any interest or ability to expand to have non-North Dakota sources of CO2 end up injected into North Dakota pore space?
Chairman McKay and committee members, great question. So first of all, I want to just clarify that it's private investment that are building up multi-state pipelines into North Dakota's Williston Basin, and with that, what we see, and I touched on it a little bit, but we look at it in terms of carbon management and our energy industry and the future of our energy industry in the state. And for North Dakota, we have world-class resource with the Bakken Formation in particular. And we, we're tasked as a state to maximize that resource for the betterment of the state. And we see CO2 enhanced oil recovery as the future opportunity to maximize our oil and gas resources in the state, specifically the Bakken. If we were to just pull together all of our stationary sources of CO2 in North Dakota, we wouldn't have enough CO2 to flood the Bakken and to maximize recovery. And so we know as a state that we need CO2 from outside of North Dakota for future CO2 enhanced oil recovery into the Bakken formation in particular and other oil and gas formations. We also see benefit to the agriculture industry in general with projects, say, that are aggregating multiple ethanol facilities across the Midwest and bringing that CO2 into North Dakota. We see a benefit in general to our agriculture industry in our state. So there's multiple benefits there. And to answer your question directly, yes, North Dakota is looking like there's projects that are being under development where there's going to be out of state CO2. And I like to kind of further point. There's two gas processing facilities in Wyoming, Chute Creek and Lost Cabin gas processing facilities, and there's a CO2 pipe. They're capturing the CO2 off those facilities. There's a pipeline that goes through Wyoming into southeastern Montana, and it's actually just been extended last year into the very southwestern portion of North Dakota. And that CO2 is being injected by Denbury Resources into one of our unconventional fields for enhanced oil recovery. And so that CO2 is Wyoming CO2 coming into North Dakota for CO2 enhanced oil recovery. And again, my point earlier, where CO2 has been captured in North Dakota and transported to southern Saskatchewan, and that CO2 from the Dakota gasification plant has been utilized for now over 20 years. They've stored over 40 million tons of CO2 in the oil fields in southern Saskatchewan. So,
thank you.
Okay, Rep. Mears has another question.
Thank you, through the chair. We've mostly been discussing the financial implications, which is, you know, mostly where we're at with this process, and it sounds like we might need to speak with the state about some of our financial questions. But I've got a technical one. Are there any requirements or parameters for the carbon dioxide pipeline, like certain parameters that you meet, folks need to meet to put CO2 into the pipelines?
Chairman McKay and committee members, CO2 pipelines have been regulated. You know, I don't have the exact number for many years. There are CO2 pipelines that go from, I believe, Colorado into West Texas. There's CO2 pipelines in the Gulf, other parts of the Gulf region. We have operated CO2 pipelines in North Dakota, Wyoming, Montana, and those pipelines are regulated by PHMSA. There's actually pipeline specifications that the transporter wants to see in terms of quality of CO2, and then the pipeline routing and siting of those pipelines that I can speak to in our region is typically regulated and sited by, you know, state public service commissions that have received that authority from PHMSA. PHMSA is the federal pipeline hazardous material safety administration. I hope I answered the question.
Okay. Yeah, I think what we've been talking about up here, Mr. Connors, is that, you know, CO2 is very corrosive. So I know that pipelines and well bores need to be designed to take into account the corrosive nature of the gas. So any other follow-up, Rep. Mears, or you okay?
Chairman McKay, I'd love to address the corrosive nature of CO2. You know, CO2 is corrosive when introduced with water. And so typically what we're looking to do is dehydrate that CO2, remove the water at the point of capture, and prepare it for transport and then injection into the well. The wells are designed as a safety precaution. The pipelines are designed for the corrosive nature of CO2, but again, it's CO2 itself is not corrosive. When CO2 is introduced with water, it becomes corrosive. I can speak in more detail if you'd like on the class 6 injection well requirements, material requirements, and corrosive monitoring if the committee would like.
Okay. Okay, Rep. Mears.
So I'll follow up on that. I'd love to get into that later. We're not quite there yet, but one of the reasons why I wanted to bring up those parameters is, you know, we're setting up this framework, some expectations for businesses that are looking to get into this. They need to be thinking about to utilize our pore space, thinking about what parameters that they need to meet. So it's sort of that expectation setting was where I was approaching this from. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, I'm looking like maybe, okay, Rep. Sadler.
We got a good guy answering questions, so I'm going to keep asking questions. Through the chair, Mr. Connors, let's see, if there are, in North Dakota's experience, have there been conflicts between the extractive industries and those that are injecting CO2? Obviously, I think there's more value in pulling oil out of the ground than injecting gas into the ground, but have there been any such conflicts in your experience, and how might they have shaken themselves out?
Chairman McKay, committee members, there have not been conflicts that I'm aware of. As I mentioned, you know, everything we're doing is derived from the oil and gas industry. The oil and gas industry is very interested in CCS and advancing CCS in the state. And the state has had foresight in terms of identifying the mineral as dominant, the mineral state, in terms of developing storage projects. Part of the demonstration or application of those storage projects is identifying any mineral-bearing formations and ensuring that those mineral-bearing formations have, or I guess the mineral developer or the mineral owner has access to those minerals. And so there's actually law and regulation around ensuring that any CO2 storage activity wouldn't prohibit anyone from developing or extracting their minerals.
Okay.
Another question to the chair, Mr. Conner, is kind of a different topic. I know that there's always environmental concerns and passions in Alaska about anything to do with the oil and gas. I suspect you had the same in North Dakota. Was there any organized resistance to the carbon capture and storage industry developing in North Dakota? And if so, what might have been effective in answering the skeptics or the critics?
Chairman McKay and committee members, I wouldn't say there's been any sort of resistance to developing projects. I think today, you know, because we're dealing with force-based rights and landowner rights, there have been landowner groups and landowners that have shown concern. And so that's why it's all important for us to be, for these particular projects, to be compensating force-based owners. And I want to just maybe build on that a little bit. And I mentioned the resource management framework, but I didn't contrast that with the other type of framework, which is a waste disposal framework. Today, and it really was, you know, it started back in 2010 when EPA published the Class 6 rule. You gotta understand the Class 6, requirements are a waste disposal framework. EPA, as far as I can see in my background and understanding and expertise in the underground injection control program, really started with the Class 1 hazardous waste well requirements and then customized those requirements for the unique nature of CO2 and the large volume injection of CO2. And so, you know, for an EPA program today or EPA permit for a Class 6 well is very much a waste disposal framework and does not take into account force-based ownership. And so that's where we really see the importance for states to apply for and receive Class 6 primacy and states' legislatures to enact force-based laws and force-based ownership considerations. Because today, certainly I would think an operator could come into the state of Alaska, apply to the EPA regional office for a Class 6 permit, and be injecting CO2 without necessarily compensating for pore space. I mean, I could be wrong. I think that could happen in other states in the United States, that states in particular that don't have defined pore space ownership or that ownership defined in legislation. And so that's why, you know, through the P-Corps partnership and through my experience with North Dakota, I've spent the last several years talking and working with other states and participating in other state work groups so states could understand the importance of these key policies and regulations that EPA just can't account for. They don't have the authority under the Safe Drinking Water Act to account for pore space ownership when they permit a site. It is very much a waste disposal framework, and there's no compensation considerations for EPA. They're looking for environmental criteria, specifically the protection of underground sources of drinking water, and there's no part of that Class 6 application when EPA is the authority that takes into account ownership and leasing or access to that pore space.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Connors. Any other questions? I could think of probably a whole lot more, but I'll just say that it's really great to talk to an entity that's actually doing this. It helps us understand a lot better and maybe get a lot more comfortable with the concept and the project. I'm looking around at my people. Any other questions? Oh, I'm sorry. Rep. Mears.
Thank you. Just a general statement that I'd like to take some time and look some more into these projects that they've got going on so I can get a better feel of, you know, what our future may be. It's interesting. There are ethanol projects that are on the top of the list here, which is from agriculture, you know, producing ethanol, which is not something that we're going to have. But I think there's probably still some lessons to be learned from those projects. Thank you.
Rep. Sadler.
I will say thank you through the chair. Mr. Carnes, again, yeah, thank you for your information. It's very helpful to ask someone who's kind of is there and is doing that. In your report, I see a conclusion and recommendations. Anything you'd want to draw special attention to or anything you'd like to add to us as what your recommendations might be to Alaska as we consider implementing a carbon capture and storage regimen in our state? Any advice you might give us?
Chairman McKay, committee members, thank you for this opportunity. I wish I could be there in Juneau. I'm much more of an in-person kind of guy. You can see I was fumbling with the technology, and I shouldn't have been. But it's a little hard to get to Juneau, I noticed. I'd have to take multiple different airlines to get there. And I looked into it, and I think in the future I'd be happy to come up and present in person and have the opportunity to discuss further. My recommendation is to pass, you know, in advance House Bill 50. I think it's a key part of the future of Alaska's ability to manage carbon dioxide emissions while having a thriving energy industry. What I didn't mention is what we're seeing today outside of those industries is we're seeing a lot of interest in direct air capture. And there's a lot of investment today behind direct air capture. Now there's that technology is still very much in demonstration. It's small scale today, but I think there's ability to upscale direct air capture, and I think Alaska would have an opportunity with that type of technology and that type of industry. And then we're also seeing a hydrogen economy, and we're seeing in North Dakota have an opportunity there. And it's because of, you know, and with hydrogen, there's a CCS component or a storage component associated with that. And so, again, it really comes down to the geology. It comes down to the industry. But those things don't really go anywhere without the policy and the laws in place and then followed by the regulatory frameworks. And what I really recommend is, advancing House Bill 50. Applying for and pursuing Class 6 primacy coupled with a resource management framework. Don't just adopt the waste disposal framework, but make it a resource management framework. And I think that gives you all the tools that you need to have a great, bright future in Alaska with the ability to manage the carbon emissions associated with your industries.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Connors. I have Representative Dibert.
Thank you through the chair. Mr. Connors, if I could go back, there was a lot of information here. You mentioned there is an admin fund and a management fund. Can you tell me more about the management fund for North Dakota?
Chairman McKay, committee members, so this was part of the early work of the IOGCC or the Interstate Oil and Gas Compact Commission. They recognized there's a few key pieces that states need to regulate that really fall outside of the Class 6 framework. And I kind of already alluded to one. It's the pore space, ownership, and property rights issues, right? There's also on the back end of a storage project. So after the project's been project's operated and then the project comes to an end and you begin the process of site closure. And then we start looking at that long-term caretaker role. And again, this falls in that resource management framework that was originally developed by the IOGCC, adopted by North Dakota, and I think a few other states are very much pursuing that, including Wyoming. But there's this long-term caretaker role that the state takes responsibility for the storage, for the stored CO2. And so that's where there's a trust fund account that's paid basically during the operational phase of the project. There's a post-closure phase where the operator demonstrates that the CO2 is stable, that the wells have been properly closed or plugged, and that the site's been reclaimed. But there's long-term monitoring function or caretaker role that the state is willing to take on, and that's funded throughout the operational life of the project. And we look at that a few different ways. And I think probably the most telling way is these companies don't last forever. There's the two the two longest standing institutions in the world, I think, are the Catholic Church and the state government, or the government. And so, and certainly, I don't think the Catholic Church is going to take over the long-term monitoring of a closed site, but the state government is more, we can project out that the state government will be there long-term, versus companies that dissolve, go into bankruptcy, change hands, things like that. And so we wanted, the IOGCC recognized that, really derived from understanding the oil and gas industry and, the different, just the industry and its progression over time. And so the Interstate Oil and Gas Compact Commission Task Force recognized that need for that caretaker role, that long-term role.
You good?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, Rep. McCabe has a question.
Thank you. And through the chair, so I have a question about the direct air capture. You seem to know quite a bit about that, sort of a frontier technology. And I get that. I mean, it's developing pretty rapidly, though. So we have a area in Alaska here, the third most populous area, that has an issue with PM2.5 because of temperature inversion in the geographic area. You suppose a direct air capture sort of scheme or strategy would be good for reducing PM2.5, take the solids out and inject the CO2, or is that a sort of a rainbows and unicorns kind of thing?
Chairman McKay and committee members, I would love to be able to answer that question. It's definitely not part of my expertise. And so I'm just sorry. I just can't answer that question. But what we have seen is a lot of interest and investment today, with the direct air capture industry, to really advance that technology and to scale it up. And so, again, it's tied to, the ability to store that CO2 once it is captured, and geology is key to that. Having the right geology. Typically, you're looking for key criteria. You need to have depth. Typically, it's around 2,600 foot depth, because what you're doing is you're compressing the CO2 at the surface to a supercritical state. So you're making a dense phase CO2. So it's a smaller molecule, basically. If it's a smaller molecule, the smaller it is, the more you can store. And so as you go down to the subsurface, you need to maintain that temperature and pressure. And so that's why we want to see a certain depth. You also need to have the right formation that will receive the CO2, cap rock above and below. And then, we're looking for low quality, water within that formation, or saline formation, right? Or a depleted reservoir. And so those are some of the criteria we're looking for, that regardless what your capture, facility looks like, whether it's direct air capture or retrofitting a coal plant, that the geology is key in everything we're doing.
Thanks.
Okay, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, through the chair, Mr. Connors. I'm trying to get my head around how CO2 used in enhanced oil recovery, which of course gets you some 45Q tax credit, how that works in a system. If you were intriguing me when you said that you saw in North Dakota they might be using CO2 to increase recovery rates from the Bakken formations. So if you have carbon from a ethanol plant or some coal-fired plant or something, and you use that for enhanced oil recovery and you claim a tax credit, then that CO2 has to remain in the ground, in a closed loop essentially, forever in order to obtain that credit. Or is there something I'm missing just about how that happens? I can see my model is understanding in Prudhoe Bay, where CO2 produced as part of natural gas is reinjected in essentially the same reservoir. But if you're taking CO2 from outside the system and using it to enhance oil recovery from the Bakken, it has to remain in a closed loop, and contained, in order to obtain the tax credit. Is that correct?
Chairman McKay and committee members, yes, that's correct. And so we've done the EERC, the Peace Corps Partnership, other research organizations have done quite a bit of work over the years to demonstrate that CO2 that's injected for enhanced oil recovery is storage. We call it associated storage versus dedicated storage, which is how we refer to geologic storage of carbon dioxide. But essentially that CO2, again, is injected. It mixes with the oil. It actually causes the oil to swell. and then flow more easily, where you're actually able to recover oil that you couldn't technically recover without CO2. There's just oil that's going to stay within the pore throats of the rock. And so the CO2, when it comes in contact with the hydrocarbon, it is actually mobilizing it for you to be able to, again, maximize recovery. Some CO2 is actually replacing itself into the pore throat that the hydrocarbon moves out of. And so you're getting some CO2 that stays in the reservoir. But yes, correct. When you produce that oil to the surface, you're going to produce some CO2 with it. But when we've done that work, and we basically say it's a closed system. And so once it's entered the system, it stays in the system. And there is a tax credit available for that. And it's been well demonstrated. I believe United States has been a leader in CO2 enhanced oil recovery since, I think, the 1970s. And so we've done quite a bit of work. There's more work to be done in formations like the Bakken that are tight oil. And also another point with CO2 enhanced recovery, predominantly the majority of the CO2 that's used in CO2 EOR is naturally occurring CO2. So they're finding sources of CO2 in the subsurface, extracting that CO2 and using it for enhanced oil recovery. Big picture vision, what we'd like to see is anthropogenic CO2 or man-made CO2 captured off of our major industries and stored in association with enhanced oil recovery. Now, that's a general statement. That's for the United States in general, not necessarily North Dakota.
Just a brief follow-up.
Okay, Rep. Sadler.
Thank you. Following up through the chair. So if CO2 is used for EOR, then and it gets scored as such to obtain the tax credit, then there's an obligation to store that forever after it's used for EOR. So essentially, if you produce oil using EOR, you're going to have to scrub out the CO2 and inject it back in and always make sure you have a handle on it. Is that correct? And I assume there's some way to measure it and monitor it and make sure of this. I assume there's some way to measure it and make sure that same amount for which you claimed a tax credit is under control forever and ever.
Chairman McKay, committee members, absolutely. And we have a long technical history of this. Keep in mind, the oil industry today and has been for many years is buying that CO2, which has a value. They don't want to lose any of that CO2. So if they're producing that CO2, they are very much separating that CO2 out and recycling it back into the system to use that CO2. So the CO2 enhanced oil recovery industry, the oil and gas industry, I think would completely agree that CO2, once it enters the system, it doesn't leave. And like I said, we've done some work on that in that space to demonstrate that. And so and then also to affirm your statement with the 45Q tax credit, yes, that is. To receive the tax credit, you need to show that CO2 is permanently stored. In other words, that CO2 won't be released to the atmosphere, and you can keep that credit and not have to give it back, right?
Great, thanks.
Okay, I think I better give Mr. Connors a rest. No, seriously, Mr. Connors, we really appreciate the time you've taken with us today. This has been extraordinarily valuable to give us a real life feel for how this works. And with that, I'll let you stand down. And in the interest of time, we've got some other business to take care of. So if there's no other questions, we really appreciate Kevin Connors being with us today. And maybe we'll reach out to you again. And we're really grateful. And if you left for Juneau tonight, you could probably get here by the middle of next week. So go ahead and you get started on that journey, and we'll see you next week, right? So anyway, thank you, Mr. Connors. It's been a pleasure, and we'll move on to our next topic.
The pleasure is mine. Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you.
Now we'll bring back the DNR to the table. Mr. Crowther, I see, is in our audience. Mr. Crowther, could you please come forward to answer further questions that members may have with the time we have remaining. Committee members, please note that the DNR has been working on answers to some of our questions. We may get some today. We may get some next week. Specifically, they're working on a big picture financial flow chart along with some other information that will be helpful for us all to understand the potential risks and benefits of this legislation. We plan to have the DNR back on Monday to present that material. So I have a couple questions, but I'll let the committee members go first with Mr. Crowther. Okay. That's unusual. Rep Mears, go ahead.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Is the intent right now just a Q&A?
It's kind of open forum. We have Mr. Crowther here, and it's your. I've got a couple questions just to provoke a conversation, but go ahead if you have a question.
I'm just wrapping my arms around procedure, what we're doing right now. I would love to hear your questions and get started.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. We'll get her going here. Representative McCabe.
So, yeah, big question I have. Mr. Crowther had a constituent send me a question, and since actually he's not really a constituent, a concerned citizen sent me a question, and he's concerned about environmental impact statements. So there was a recent article that came out that said this could cause an earthquake, and he's also concerned about environmental impact statements. I assume that as part of the either the EPA requirement or our Class 6 or Title 6 primacy requirements, we'll be doing an environmental impact statement for the footprint for sure, although, I mean, we permit wells all the time or even injection wells, but there will be some sort of studies done through NEPA or the EPA or our primacy, right?
So, Representative McCabe, through the chair, and for the record, John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources here. So for projects on state lands, we don't do environmental impact statements as a technical term, but we do what we call best interest findings, and that includes an analysis of the surface impact, surface activities, including environmental impacts. So that would certainly be part of the analysis the department does for these at the leasing level when a exploration license or lease is issued. But there also is subsequent, you know, specific development project approvals that take into consideration things like environmental impact and footprint. Similarly, the AOGCC, in the course of their regulatory efforts to monitor the wells, you know, that's a safety, an environmental impact of those wells is taken into consideration, and to make sure that the injection proceeds without releases or migration to other reservoirs. So that's accurate, sir.
Follow up.
Please, Mr. Rep. McCabe.
And thanks. So more of a statement, I guess, less of a question. So, you know, trying to refocus this back to the fact that we are laying a framework to allow this to move forward. I have some folks that have been concerned that we're rushing headlong into this and we're going to create earthquakes and big environmental disasters and all of that sort of stuff, and they need reassurance that this money that we're spending and this what we're doing right now is a necessary statutory framework to allow the exploration, to allow the environmental impact statements or the best interest finding statements or the Title VI. None of that can start without the framework, the legislative framework, to get this going. And I guess I'm looking for a thumbs up or thumbs down. We're not rushing pell-mell into this. We've had 6 hearings on it, and I bet there's more scheduled. We've had all kinds of invited testimony, and I know that we'll probably have public testimony, and they'll get a chance to talk about their issues with ESG, which we all hate, the use of carbon as carbon tax credits as money and all those sort of ideas and strategies. But really they're looking for assurance, and I'm looking for assurance that this is the very beginning, and we can't even really start without defining where we want to go.
Representative McCabe, through the chair, the intent is to put a framework into place. So thumbs up.
Thank you.
I was going to call on Commissioner Huber of the Oil and Gas Commission to maybe address the subsurface technical issues, but Rep. Sadler, you have a question.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And whether it's Commissioner Crowther, Deputy Commissioner Crowther, or Chairman Huber who can answer this. So to put a fine point on Representative McCabe's question, We currently have an oil and gas leasing framework that's in place that allows enhanced oil recovery, which includes injection of CO2 into underground basins. We're considering a parallel CO2 injection framework that will allow us to inject CO2 into underground basins. Have there been any records or experience of earthquakes caused by injection of natural gas and CO2 into the ground at North Slope yet? Ever?
So, Representative Sadler, through the chair, not being a geologist, it's my understanding that we have not seen seismic activity on the North Slope associated with 40 to 50 years of gas cycling, you know, heavy-duty compression and reinjection of that gas. The North Slope is not a very seismically active area at all, and we've seen, I think, just a few earthquakes in kind of the human observable range attributed just to general geologic factors up there in kind of recent history. I would note, I believe in some prior testimony, our state geologist Dave LePayne spoke about the study of seismic events associated with the injection, and has not identified that as an area of concern. One of the primary drivers there is because the intent of injecting carbon dioxide is to maintain the reservoir quality, so you're not creating structural changes to the geology. It is true that in some other areas of the United States, there has been some small seismic activity attributed to injecting highly compressed things to purposely fracture formations, and that is the goal, and the regulatory limitation is to not do that with CO2 injection.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Commissioner Huber, can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, I was hoping, Commissioner Huber, maybe you could also answer Rep. Sadler's question. And, you know, from my experience in the industry in Alaska, I can't remember a time when there's been a specific earthquake caused by oil and gas activities either in the Kenai area or on the slope. And then maybe you could talk about, I know that the commission would tightly regulate the whole operation subsurface. We don't want to go above frac pressure, for example. The wells would be designed to handle the corrosion, and we would be very careful that everything's goes where it's supposed to go. So maybe you could talk to that as an expert in that field.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate it. Thank you. And I think you've characterized it correctly. So the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission does have the regulatory authority in this area. We have a very thorough permitting process. We would consider all of those things, including formation integrity, geologic integrity, well pressures, field pressures, injection pressures, all those things that we do now as a matter of course with our oil and gas business as we're dealing with cycling and enhanced oil recovery and injection in those areas. Not to our knowledge, there's not been an injection-caused earthquake activity even in Cook Inlet. The injection for this would actually be at a depth greater than the fracture zone, so I think any possibility of that, I wouldn't say it's impossible, but I would say it is extremely unlikely, and it hasn't been observed to happen so far. So there are two ways to introduce seismic events, and neither would be approved if it came to this commission. So we have the ability to regulate as you've described, Mr. Chairman, and I hope that helps answer those questions. If there's follow-ups, we remain available.
Okay. You want to follow up? Okay, thank you, Commissioner Huber. So I look to the committee if they have any other questions for the folks we have here with us today. Going once, okay. Going twice. I know Daniel.
It's okay if you don't have one today.
I could take a brief at ease if you need to recharge. Okay. No, I want to thank our committee. I really do. You've been very engaged and great questions, and this is part of the vetting and due diligence. And I want to thank the committee for your hard work on this bill. So what I'd like to say at this point is thank you, Mr. Crowther. We'll see you and your staff next week. For the benefit of the committee and the public, I'd like to clarify that the committee substitute for this bill was requested from our legislative legal department a couple days ago, to address technical issues that our lawyers flagged when reviewing the bill that was drafted by the governor's legal team, which is not unusual to have a back and forth between those two entities before you arrive at something you can vote on. We requested further changes to address issues that the administration brought to our attention as needing further clarity. There will be an opportunity to offer amendments before the bill leaves this committee, okay? And drafting and adopting a committee substitute to address technical issues does not imply that the members of this committee are our sponsors or supporters of the bill. This is always going to be a governor's bill, okay? So I will now set HB 50 aside. Is there any other business? All right, seeing none, the next committee meeting will be held at 1 o'clock on Monday, February 27th. This meeting is adjourned at 2:23 p.m. Thank you very much.